Hey, what's up, guys? Travis here. And if you've been following me or my story for any length of time, you know that I started a company called Guestio about a year and a half ago now. And one of the things that we are doing this year in 2022 is we're building a concierge program called the Fast Pass that allows you to get booked on top quality shows and platforms for the purpose of spreading awareness for your brand, grabbing attention, growing your credibility, your authority, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you are listening to this right now and you are a seven-figure plus entrepreneur and you have a budget to bring in traffic, attention, credibility, authority to your brand, then this might be a really great program for you. Just head over to travischappell.com/10K. Why 10K? Because we guarantee in this program that you're going to be able to speak in front of 10,000 people within 90 days. Okay, 10,000 people within 90 days. Imagine getting on a stage in front of 10,000 people to share your message, your story. Well, that's exactly what we are doing inside of this program through virtual stages like podcasts or virtual events or YouTube channels or blogs. You name it, we are working with it and we are trying to get you booked on those platforms. So travischappell.com/10x. There's a quick application there. And then right at the end of that application, it'll prompt you to set up a phone call where you'll jump on a call with me and we'll talk through whether or not you're a great fit for this program. Please act fast on this. Do not wait because we are only taking on one or two clients a week due to constraints with our team and the limited supply of high quality shows and platforms that are out there in the market. So if that's you and you're really wanting to explode your brand in 2022, head over to travischappell.com/10K, fill out the application, schedule a quick phone call, and you and I will chat really soon about whether or not this would be a great fit for you. Thanks, guys. Talk to you soon.
Hi, I'm Ed Vincent, founder of Festival Pass. And if you want to build valuable relationships, you should be listening to Build Your Network with my good friend Travis Chappell and Eric Swarzynski.
If you're tired of the old way of networking, the business cards, the awkward conversations, and the aggressive pitches, but you know how crucial your network is to your success in life, then you're in the right place. Welcome to Build Your Network, the only top-rated show committed to helping you master content networking, foster real relationships, increase your authority, and build the network of your dreams. Listen in on conversations with world-class entrepreneurs, authors, thought leaders, and more as we deconstruct their best strategies for your success. So get ready to burn your business cards, ditch the name tag, and discover the new way to network with your host, Travis Chappell.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Build Your Network podcast. Ed, thank you so much for joining me on today's show.
Hey, Eric. How are you? I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, excited to have you here. And you definitely have a really interesting journey I want to talk about today, but I like to take these conversations back to the very beginning. Tell me a little bit about childhood, Ed. What was kind of your original idea of where you would be as an adult? What were some of your interests and kind of personality traits early on?
Sure. So I don't know if I knew exactly where I wanted to be, but I've always been an entrepreneurial kid. I grew up in a kind of nice town on the Jersey Shore, but we were the poorest family in the rich town. So I was always looking at things that were around me, knowing that, well, I don't have the money for that. My family doesn't have the money, but I'm willing to work to have things, or not even have things, just be able to do things. Experiences are more important to me. So yeah, as a 10-year-old, I was putting newspapers together to get $5 and a free breakfast. And that was kind of the beginning of the journey.
Right, right. Yeah, it seems like, I mean, very early on career-wise, I mean, you were pretty hardcore into business numbers. Were you always kind of analytical? Or did you have a creative side that was super evident early on? Or was it purely like running numbers, trying to start doing these little business ventures here and there?
Yeah, I mean, I was a finance major and I was an investment banker. So I think that's kind of on the side of the financial stuff. But the reality was, I've always looked at myself as a pretty even mix between left brain and right brain. The idea that you can be creative in many facets, I just appreciated a little bit of the knowledge around, you know, I used to say that it doesn't matter what kind of entrepreneur you are, you should understand how a financial model works, because it's really hard. Yeah, by looking at a financial model, you can see the how a business actually operates.
Right, right. Well, you started initially kind of in the baking world. That was kind of your first venture out into business. Can you tell me a little bit about those early experiences and maybe some of the things that you liked and disliked about being in that space?
Sure. So there's even more context to that. I had started in college in my dorm room, a real estate appraisal firm. So okay. I used to value homes for banks and mortgage companies that were lending to individuals. And in that process, it was the concept of valuation, right? So I was valuing hard assets, real estate. And in that mechanism, there's really only three ways to value anything. It's either you're valuing it a discounted cash flow of what that asset can produce, or you're valuing it as a comparable to other things like it, and then making adjustments if it's a little different. And that's how most of the stock market is driven today. And then the third piece is, what if you had to build it from scratch, what would it cost? And those three mechanisms of value still persist today in almost every aspect of finance. But the reason I bring that up is the valuing real estate turned into valuing companies, which then turned into banking.
So in 2001, pivoting into e-commerce, so going in from, you know, banking, you're working in that industry, sounded like you were very successful within that world. What was it that triggered you to exit that and go into kind of the e-commerce space?
New Year's parties. and what I mean that actually seriously is a good friend of mine and I, we used to throw these big parties and have a lot of friends around. So for many years, we would throw big New Year's parties in New York City and in the northern part of New Jersey. And it was an epiphany in 1999, while I was a banker, we decided that, hey, wow, we can actually take credit cards online to pay for New Year's tickets, as opposed to running all around the five boroughs of Manhattan, trying to collect cash from random people and giving them tickets. And that was kind of the epiphany. And from that point in time, you know, being in banking, I really do enjoy kind of the overall finance world and community. And it's really helped me today looking at structuring of investments and structuring of capital raising. But the reality was at the time, I was always a service provider. And I was helping other people structure and raise capital as an investment banker. But I really wanted to be the one running the company. I wanted the one to actually be doing the operations and creating the ideas and using the finances to be able to grow.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's kind of one of the things I thought was interesting about your resume, for lack of a better word, is that you had so much time within the traditional model of business. Like, you were working as part of a cog in the larger machine, and then venturing out into your own with, you know, digital technology becoming more and more available, being able to kind of operate at a scale that you couldn't have imagined, I'm sure, when you first started taking that initial job. Like, how do you operate something that can potentially grow like an e-commerce business or a SaaS company and operate it yourself with not as much capital as you would expect to need early on? What was your first venture into that space? Was it purely just doing those parties, or did you start very early, like kind of pushing into a product and trying to make that your main source of income?
Yeah, no. So there was a point in time while I was at the bank that I decided to leave. And that's when we launched, my partner and I, the one who we used to throw the New Year's parties with, we launched something called citystuff.com. That was the first e-commerce company. And that was in the classic internet 1.0 days of, you know, New York City and California. And it was pre-Google, pre-Facebook. And it was just fascinating to be in a place where you actually had to build all of the software yourselves. So, you know, it was a lot more expensive to build an e-commerce platform, you know, in the millions, as opposed to, you know, now you could pull Shopify off the shelf and start an e-commerce business tomorrow.
The lack of like saturation, because now it seems like everybody has a Shopify store. Everybody's got some kind of online, at least merch. They're selling t-shirts or something. Do you feel, obviously hindsight's 2020, so it's hard to really gauge these things, but do you feel like there was an advantage to getting into it so early where there were so few in the space? Or do you feel like with how much work went into having to build just to make it functional, do you feel it was a more difficult time to jump into it?
Yeah, it's hard to put a specific answer to that. I mean, back then it was there was the beginning of the unknown. So there's just the idea of what could be, and that was the whole kind of 1.0 stage, and nobody knew what like the real business model was going to play out to be. And if you look back in history, you realize that there were a bunch of companies that didn't have business models that got funding. But what made it much easier today is to be able to have a concept and idea and test it with, right. You know, with $50,000, you can be out there testing a product, a concept, you know, social media and finding an audience didn't exist back then. It was all about advertising. You needed millions of dollars of advertising to tell people what your .com was so they could actually arrive at your page. There was no such thing as search engines.
Yeah. It's crazy thinking to a time where it's the wild, wild west of of marketing and like having to manage that balance between the physical marketing, the online marketing. And it is, it's, I was talking to somebody earlier today on an interview, and I was saying, it's crazy that the people sitting in classrooms, it's the reason I love talking back to childhood. People sit in classrooms thinking about what they want to be when they grow up. And most of those jobs now didn't exist when they were sitting in that kindergarten classroom. It's a totally new frontier, just from where you're talking about starting to now where every, you know, 17, 18 year old I know who has any kind of business sense is starting Shopify stores and drop shipping from China. And it's like, it's crazy. It's just unbelievable that that's the position we're in. I have to ask you this, and this is a question. I heard you mention this on a show, and I have to ask because I'm morbidly curious about it. Sure. Part of your career that stands out to me is you spent some time doing data for MoviePass. And when I first looked at your current company, in my mind, I thought, oh, it looks like MoviePass. It was like very similar in the kind of core concept of what it is. But you worked with the data for MoviePass for a while. And how long was that period? Was it a fairly short period, or was it fairly long running?
So there's two things. So the core business model between MoviePass and Festival Pass is very, very, very different. So I'm happy to dive into that and share that. So I want to make that crystal clear, because it's a MoviePass, while very interesting of a product market fit, had some flaws in the business model. But I was there for about 18 months. I had a data company that I founded called Predict Analytics that was about a four or five year company. And during that time, MoviePass found me and my company because of a lot of the work we'd done for a lot of big television and film companies. So we were working with A&E Networks and AMC Networks and Screen Vision and lots of these other big companies. And they saw that we had an expertise in really understanding consumer data in the entertainment space. So they needed, as they were growing so rapidly, by the time I joined them, I joined them through my company. So they hired my company and then actually asked me to come in as their chief data officer on an interim basis. And it was fascinating. You know, they had grown from 20,000 subscribers to 3.5 million in less than a year, and now had all this data with 3.5 million subscribers and needed a strategy on, well, what do we do with this data? How do we not only have data governance, but then how do we ensure we're monetizing the data and not necessarily monetizing it through selling it, but utilizing it to grow the business model?
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating to me because MoviePass feels, I mean, I've joked with some friends, like I'd love an Aaron Sorkin script and get a movie made about, you know, MoviePass, like we got a Social Network or something like that. It would be an interesting journey. But I was curious from your perspective, you're sitting there with the data, you're looking at information. Like when MoviePass came out, I was sitting there going, this seems too good to be true. You know, and that's kind of everybody's reaction. That's why they gained, you know, as many subscribers as they did in a short period of time. When you first sat down and looked at the company, did you have in your mind these red flags of, this is not going to work, this is too good to be true, this isn't going to function? Or was there a path that where that company and that model, $9 a month to go see unlimited movies, could have worked for them?
Yeah, so there was a very solvable path to success. Okay. And you know, if I can think back without naming names or individual people, most of the management team were very highly skilled, successful people, and many agreed on the path for success. And I'm pretty sure today, if it had been implemented upon recommendation, and I was one of the recommenders, that MoviePass still would, well, COVID could have hurt it, but outside of COVID, it could have had a sustainable business. And the truth is at the time, I'm trying to remember the actual numbers, but the large majority of people that were ever canceling the service would have been happy to pay more money. And many of the people would have been happy to be limited on the number of films they could see in a month. The problem was, is that it just, there wasn't some buy-in from certain levels of management of the difference between growth at all costs versus building a sustainable business model. And that there's a lot of underlying issues with any kind of subscription model where you don't control the gross margin.
Yeah. Was that kind of the nail in the coffin, you feel like, was just the unwillingness to adjust the pricing or put restrictions on the subscription?
I do. I mean, at the end of the day, when a lot of it inspired what we were doing here at Festival Pass is that I promised myself I would never build a business where when I asked people to do more of what I originally brought them to the platform to do, that then I would lose money. The idea in the MoviePass days is, you know, over 70% of the individuals weren't getting value and about 25% were getting too much value. So it was really it was a pendulum shift where it was very difficult to keep people happy when most were not getting value, but only the select few were, you know, effectively abusing the system, if you will. But the model shouldn't be in a position where that's allowed. You know, one of the core differences with what we've done, and many companies out there have learned, not many, but a few have learned how to fix that. I don't know if you're familiar with ClassPass as a company.
Yeah, I'd looked into them a little bit after I'd heard you had compared your platform to ClassPass meets Airbnb. And so I looked a little bit into them.
Yeah. And the biggest core there is they had a lot of the same problems MoviePass did for the first 4 years of their existence, 5 years. Mm-hmm. And the hard part is whenever you have a business model where somebody else owns the inventory and you're a marketplace to share that, the only way to ensure positive gross margin metrics on every transaction, which is what creates a sustainable growing company, is to ensure that you have some level of dynamic pricing for the type of product. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that really made it hard for MoviePass or any film-driven company is the exhibitors who were providing that inventory, meaning those tickets, they didn't control the pricing. Studios controlled the pricing. So you could, you know, you can go to a movie at noon, you know, at an empty theater, pay $15 in New York City, or you can go Friday night at 8 o'clock and pay $15 in New York City. There's no such thing as dynamic pricing. And, you know, one of the goals out there was to create a dynamic pricing environment, but it was too difficult with the structure that the traditional film kind of business worked. Vastly different in what ClassPass built, vastly different in what we're doing in live events. And, you know, the good news is there's a huge opportunity out there to build a sustainable long-term model that is good for the consumer and good for the business.
Right. What would you say before we move into Festival Pass, and this is adjacent to it, is what would you say are maybe two or three of the top lessons that you would give? And you've given a couple practical, specifically relating to companies like MoviePass, but for those running subscription companies, period, what would be two or three pieces of advice you'd really encourage them to take to heart?
Understand the underlying metrics of the cost of goods sold. When you have a traditional SaaS company where you have super high margins on software, it's relatively easy to provide, you know, different ways to acquire companies and different ways to scale it because the margin's so big and every additional unit you're delivering doesn't cost you out of pocket as significant. But when you're building a marketplace where somebody else is the owner of that inventory, whether that's a service-based business like an Uber or Lyft or anything else, you just have to know your margins. And as long as you're not subsidizing the product each step of the way. So even in any other kind of subscription company, subscription boxes, whatever it is, as long as you know the unit economics of every transaction, there's opportunity to scale the business.
Got it. So moving into Festival Pass, which obviously you can break down a little bit of what the model is there. You're still in that subscription world a little bit. You're trying to give people access to multiple different events, keeping them at a monthly subscription price. Tell me a little bit about how that came about and kind of what the model is there.
Yeah. So back to the context of my entire kind of entrepreneurial career is I feel that each stage of the career led to the why today. Mm. And you know, and that's why I think I'm the perfect person to kind of build this company at this time. So going back to after that e-commerce company I mentioned, the next company I built was an experiential marketing company, about a 70-person agency where we would bring big brands to very big events. We helped build film festivals and large music events we'd bring brands to. It made me fall in love with the concept of what it really means to be in a unique experience that only happens once. And that's what live events really are. That that whatever that event is, whether it's a food and wine event or a Broadway show or a sporting event, it only happens at that one moment. A little different than things like, you know, TV or film that can be watched over and over and over again. It's a different experience. Not to say that seeing a movie in the theater isn't also a unique experience, because that collection of people in the seats will never actually be in that same room again for that same movie. Yeah. Anyway, that all being said, I really fell in love with live events. Fast forward to having a SaaS-based business, I started really appreciating the concept of recurring revenue to be able to understand how it makes it easier to predict future outcomes when you have the knowledge of standardized subscription-based revenue. And then moving forward to that, I built Predict Analytics, which was a big data company around entertainment. And it really allowed me to understand how data is so important in being able to build a company, to create a recommendation engine that makes the consumer experience much better, but also be able to use data to predict outcomes. So when I look at the experiential side of understanding events, the recurring business model, and then understanding how data drives it all, and then obviously having the experience at MoviePass gave me a very good perspective on what to do and what not to do in a subscription entertainment product. That all led me to what we're building today. And I can go on and on. It's a huge global opportunity. There's a $200 billion market. So it's even 20x the size of the film market.
Right. Yeah. And like you mentioned with MoviePass, it's a perfect learning experience to get to see what went wrong. And, you know, you got to see firsthand, probably more than most people, you got to see from the ground up, like where things kind of taking a wrong turn. And, you know, with Festival Pass, for someone who's on the consumer side of it, and I definitely want to get some more on the business side, for someone who's a consumer, what could they expect from taking advantage of Festival Pass, and what benefits is it bringing to them?
Yeah, so lots. So it's really, instead of a subscription, I look at it as a membership, right? So when people are signing up to be a part of Festival Pass, and I think I said it a little bit earlier, but festivals is really just a go-to-market brand. We're not just festivals. We're any live event, any music performance, any sporting event, theater, food and wine events. So it's really not just festivals. But that all being said is when the consumer joins, they'll have access to be able to budget. And one thing I learned a lot, one of our investors and advisory board members is one of the kind of most well-known millennial and Gen Z experts around the globe, a guy by the name of Jason Dorsey. And he sees it on a daily basis of how millennials and how Gen Zs tend to like to budget their life, how they like to live through experiences like, okay, I know my rent costs X, my food costs are X, my entertainment costs are X, and the ability to kind of manage their life through that budgeting. That really helps in a situation like ours, because what we're trying to do is try to allow individuals to commit. If they're going to budget $99 a month to go to live events, they should do so with us, because then they can choose how they spend that money. So some of the benefits of doing so is one, just the pure recommendation engine that we've built that enables people to discover things that are really cool. One of the things I did learn at MoviePass was once somebody's already committed to coming to a platform, they'll discover things that they traditionally wouldn't see in the outside media. Yeah. You know, a lot of the members of MoviePass would go to an independent film they had never even heard of rather than just go to a Blockbuster because they saw a TV ad for it. So that's one great concept. There's a lot of discovery happening on Festival Pass. So somebody that might like a specific band that they see at a specific venue, you know, I'm here in Austin, Texas, so they might see, the Black Pumas at Stubbs and then realize that, hey, I like that kind of music, and 20 minutes away, they're playing at a different venue. Or, I didn't realize it, but I also would love to go to, pick your genre, a cool band playing out in wine country. That sounds awesome. So anyway, that discovery is a super helpful mechanism for the consumer. And then the big one is, one of the big ones is most ways people acquire tickets these days, or for the last, call it couple of decades is very transactional. There's not much brand loyalty there, and there's not a community. And we really are building this community of like-minded people so that it's a fun experience to share with your friends, a way to discover, a way to be social. You know, we don't charge ticketing fees. So it's a concept of transparency a little more than the fee itself is the ability for somebody to say, well, I get it. You know, if I want to go to this event, it's 22 credits. That makes sense. I might have 200 credits in my account, and that makes sense to me. I can use 22 credits to go see this band, or I can use 5 credits to go see a comedy show that I didn't even know existed before. So the idea is you can gamify your experience and choose to how to make it any way you want to make it.
Right. How have you kind of nourished that community aspect with multiple users? Because obviously live events are super communal. So you've got groups of people planning trips, going out to things like that. You mentioned community was really important. How are you kind of bringing, you know, people together in that way who are using the platform?
Yeah. So a lot of it is still on the roadmap. So we're you know, as any kind of new company, there's only so much you can do at one time. But a lot of things will happen where people will be able to connect internally. So if you're a member of Festival Pass, you'll be able to build almost like you would find on any social network, a friend connection. So you might have 100 of your friends that are also all Festival Pass members, or even connecting your Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, or others, so you know what your friends are doing. And so what will happen is as you look at different events on the platform, you'll be able to see if you're connected to your friends. Oh, John's going to this event. Susie's going to this event. That's cool. Now I want to go. Or you'll be able to go in and say, I'm going to go to this event and I want to tell all my friends that I'm going. So it automatically will trigger out either a social message or an email saying, hey, Ed is going to go see, you know, X band at X venue. Do you guys want to join? And they'll be able to come back in and find ways to engage in that way. Other things is when you get into like imagery, being at the event, we're going to want to encourage people as they're taking pictures, upload into the system, share what's going on, and then create some pretty cool, you know, facial recognition technology so that when you go in and look at the hopefully millions of photos we'll have on the platform, that all of a sudden I'll immediately see me and my friends as opposed to, you know, one of the tens of thousands that are there.
Right, right. No, that's super, super cool. Is there a benefit for, because obviously, you know, like you said, it's been very transactional. Like you just go to the cheapest place, you know, the venue's just trying to sell the tickets. So they're going, you know, Ticketmaster selling out, you know, all these different companies. Is there a benefit for venues claiming, you know, they're like a musician, you know, being available on the platform, or a venue really using Festival Pass to be their main kind of ticket seller for them?
Yeah, so there's two pieces there because they're two different questions. So if you think of it as the venue, the one thing we're not trying to do is we're not trying to displace primary ticketing companies. You know, they have relationships and those go deep and there's a function for it. So whether it's Ticketmaster or anybody else that's a primary ticketer, what we want to do is we're building this place where we're hopefully we'll have millions of members that is really a marketing channel for a lot of these venues. So the ability to gain access to a high frequency, highly motivated social group of people in order to get more people to discover their events and their products. It's important to kind of make that distinction is we're not trying to be the full ticketer of an event, but if I can sell 5 to 10% of, or when I say sell, if I can make available to my members 5 or 10% of a show, and that helps the venue fill the seats for that show, fantastic. The other thing that a lot of the venues tend to like and venues and event producers is none of them want to ever discount tickets. So the idea that, you know, I'm going to have a show and I have 1,000 tickets to sell and maybe it's a week out from the show and I've only sold 500. There are other ways traditionally people have gone about filling seats by discounting through Groupon or other places where they can do so. The problem with that is you create this concept where people can just go in and Google the ticket and find out they can get it for 40% less than Groupon rather than going direct to buy the ticket at 100%. Because we're a membership organization and because we're a credit-based currency, there's really no direct concept of discounting. So one of the venues that want to bring 100 more people to a show can provide us with, the word discount, I don't like it, but provide us with tickets for our members and potentially have a, you know, share revenue with us so that we can make the tickets, you know, available to our members at a cost that works, while right. at the same time, you know, we maintain a margin for ourselves. But the reality is it never will cannibalize their own direct ticket sales.
Right.
So it's a really innovative way to make sure everybody wins, right? The venue gets to fill more seats. Our members get special privileges for committing to a monthly subscription. And nobody that traditionally would go in and buy 100% single ticket, they're not losing that revenue.
Right. You're kind of disrupting without displacing anybody. Like nobody's getting thrown off to the side.
And that's why we use the kind of Airbnb kind of reference, right? Or HomeAway or any of those other kind of concepts, right? Is we're just a marketplace. People can bring their inventory, which is whether it's music or sports or anything. And we already have a highly engaged audience that really wants to consume that inventory. So we're just a place where people can, a centralized place, we can find tickets from hundreds of different primary ticketers, thousands of different venues, you know, dozens of different genres, and it's all in one place. And we're packaging it for our members in a very social, frictionless, consumable way. So they'll do more of it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I definitely want to talk a little bit about networking because the show is called Build Your Network. And sure. I know you've talked a little bit about how relationships helped really guide the initial ventures in your career. I'm curious, we ask this question to everybody who comes on the show. Do you believe that who you know or what you know is more important and why?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it is who you know, but the who you know just is it gets you through the door. Hmm. And the what you know is what allows the who you know to support you. Hmm. If that makes any sense. So everybody, if you have access to people that trust you and that want to empower you to succeed, then the who you know really helps. And we've seen it in our own kind of world, right? We've been lucky through relationships to have an amazing group of investors, you know, not huge, but some are smaller investors, but very influential. We have, you know, professional athletes that are investors. We have entrepreneurs that have sold companies for billions of dollars that are investors. You know, as I mentioned before, we have the global guru in millennial and Gen Z as an investor. We have the CEO of Alamo Drafthouse Film Company as an investor. Wow. So all these people really, they're wonderful people that believe in the business model and hopefully also believe in my ability to move it forward. So the who you know gets easier once you have an idea and a track record that makes it more powerful.
Right. What would you say to somebody who is reaching out to somebody? Because we have a lot of people in our listenership that have SaaS companies, they have startups, and they're reaching out to investors who are on these crazy levels, seem almost unattainable. And, you know, they're coming in with value and what they know, but they're reaching out to people who have an immense, you know, immense amount of knowledge within the business space. How do you, from your experience, how do you present yourself correctly to people that you're reaching out to? How do you bring value to somebody who is working at such a high level?
You mean in terms of like seeking somebody to be an advisor or an investor?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is just doing your homework, right? The having the ability to know why, like, do I just want this person's money, or I just want to put them on a, you know, a byline on a website to say that they're involved? If they can't really contribute, then they're not going to be a part of it. But if, you know, I can, out of the probably 20 to 25 plus individuals that invested, each one had a reason, you know, when I mentioned HomeAway before. So one of the original co-founder of HomeAway is an investor, but HomeAway is a marketplace, right? So he has tremendous marketplace experience and understands that what we're trying to build truly is a marketplace. So not only can he provide us with very unique advice, but also could see his capital going further because he can provide some expertise. You know, in the world of Alamo Drafthouse, it's expertise in understanding that entertainment space. So maybe we will eventually have movies on Festival Pass done in a way that's much different than the original Movie Pass was. Sure. I can go on and on. Each one adds value. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm curious too, as you've kind of worked your way through your career, building these organic relationships is huge. And obviously those relationships are going to fall into place, reaching out to people, making connections. What role have maybe paid masterminds or you know, paying for access to certain individuals for mentorships or things? How much have you done of that? And has that been a worthwhile investment for you?
Yeah, I would say my biggest return on networking has come through something that's not really networking. So I'm part of an entrepreneurs organization. It's called EO. I don't know if your listeners know it. It's pretty much a sister organization to YPO, which is another organization people know about. But it's really functions as a peer group. So there's 14,000 entrepreneurs globally. You know, each city has a chapter. I'm now in the Austin chapter that has about 200 people. I was in New York's chapter for 14 years with about 200 people. But what's amazing about the organization is it's global in nature. There's a ton of learning events to be able to continue to build. Just, I'm a lifelong learner, and everybody in that organization is a lifelong learner. And when you surround yourself with peers that are all constantly seeking to better themselves, both business-wise and personally, wanting to have better relationships with their friends and their children and their spouses, and wanting to have a more balanced life overall, you tend to have the ability to network. So in this organization, as an example, I can call upon any of the 14,000 people globally, and they'll take my call. And they'll do anything they can to help me find what I'm seeking. So that's one great example. And I'm also part of another group called EPX Worldwide. That's another group of kind of passionate entrepreneurs that that tend to do wanting to do nothing else but help.
Right. That's awesome. Well, I definitely appreciate you taking time to share a little bit. And I'm going to move us into our random round here. The first question I want to ask you is, what profession other than your own do you think it would be fun to attempt?
I would say the one thing I always wanted to do and never had an opportunity to is to work in the travel sector on some kind of like thing, like a yacht or a cruise ship, or you know, some amazing far off place where I spent, you know, a few years in, let's say, Bali, you know, at some kind of resort and trying to understand the different cultures.
Right. If you could sit on a park bench with anybody, past or present, and ask them anything for an hour, who would it be and why?
Rudyard Kipling, who is a author, literary poet. And the reason is, you might not be able to see it in the background, but there's a poster back there of a poem called If by Rudyard Kipling. And it's pretty much the poem that has guided my entire life since I was about 15. And if anybody wants to look it up, it's powerful. But you know, it's advice, if you will. Advice is the wrong word. It's a share that worked in the 1800s when he wrote it, and it's a share that works today. And it's things like, if you hold your head about you when all around you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can look at triumph and disaster and treat the two imposters just the same. So it's really kind of life lessons. So that's the guy I would like to sit next to.
How do you like to learn best? Is it through books, audiobooks, podcasts, videos? What's your favorite way to consume educational content?
Yeah, my favorite way, which isn't always accessible all the time, is speakers events. A lot of our EO group, we bring in some of the best speakers in the globe to come in. And I spent 3 years at a program at MIT where we just, the whole program is 3 to 4 speakers a day for a week straight. And basically they're some of the best professors, some of the best authors. To me, that's the context that is the best way to learn. But coming out of that, then most of them wrote books. So books tends to be the second best for me.
Right. Can you give me a glimpse of your morning routine?
Sure. You know, everybody used to say, you know, early risers get the worm. That's not me. I'm usually up by 7:30 or 8, get a coffee, go work out. Usually don't, I look at emails while I'm having coffee before I work out, and then come back, and by around 9:30, 10 a.m., kind of start the day, have meeting after meeting. Obviously, Zoom through COVID is a little different than a lot of the in-persons that are beginning to happen. But yeah, and then just work through the evening on various projects, and then, you know, go out, have a nice dinner, glass of wine.
Do you have a go-to pump-up song to start your day with?
No, but I have 3 daughters, so it's always a joke. They used to always get mad when I wanted to wake them up in the morning, and I'd either have It's Gonna Be a Good Day by Nappy Roots. I don't know if you know the song. And then just, you know, it's usually those morning songs like, you know, Oh, it's Oh, What a Beautiful Morning from Oklahoma. And that's a little aging me from...
That's funny. What is something that you're not very good at?
There's a difference between not being capable and not enjoying. So I do believe that I'm capable of most things, but the more I enjoy things, I tend to, it's easier for me, and therefore I succeed and are better at it. The things I like the least, which are the things that are more challenging, is just pure operational aspects of a business. Mm. So the context of paperwork, the context of, you know, filling out HR forms and, you know, going through the classic process of pure operations. And I know other people love it. So I'd rather, you know, hire in where we're going to have a new person join us in the next month or so that's going to come on the leadership team to really drive a lot of those operations.
Gotcha. What is one place online where people can connect with you the most?
Yeah, I mean, from a business perspective, mostly LinkedIn is usually the place where I'll post, you know, any kind of thing related to business or podcasts like this or other stuff like that. You know, I'm also on all the other social channels. It's fascinating how each one becomes their own mechanism. So like for Instagram, personally, it's really just me and my kids and my friends, that my close friends. On Facebook, it started that way. But then after I've met so many business people globally and entrepreneurs that tend to use Facebook often, it's fascinating how globally people use Facebook for business more so than I think they do here in the US. So I've kind of given into it, and I have tons of business friends on Facebook.
Yeah. And for the company, what's the best place for people to find out more about what you guys are offering, check it out for themselves, either as a consumer or as somebody who's interested in kind of checking out the business model?
Yeah, across the board. So we have festivalpass.com is the easiest way to actually see the product and what we're building. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, we just started to be on TikTok a couple months ago. So we're testing that out. And then also, you'll see it if you go to the website, but we have kind of a three-pronged strategy on capital raising. So while we have a lot of strategic investors that have invested millions of dollars in terms of providing operating capital, we're also doing a crowdfunding campaign through Start Engine. And if you go to invest.festivalpass.com, you'll be able to see a lot of information related to that. And there's a strategy there, because it's not where we need the capital to come from, but it's really about the democratization of allowing individuals that might be members to also invest. So it creates the loyalty of being part of the overall program. And I've always wanted to have the retail consumer be able to participate early on. So when we are the next Airbnb at 100 billion evaluation, that they didn't have to wait until we went public in order to jump in. So invest.festivalpass.com is a good way to learn about us and can invest as little as $216.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Ed, for joining me on the show. I really appreciate it. And you brought a ton of value to the audience.
I appreciate that, Eric. Thanks. It's great to be here.
That's it for this episode. If you want to connect with Travis and other like-minded people who also listen to the show, then you're going to want to head over to travischappell.com/group to join his free Facebook group, Podcast to Profit. Travis will see you there. And remember to leave every relationship better than you found it.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.